Well, thank you for coming. My broadcast has a literary thrust, but a number of times a year I like to do something on other books, travel, cookbooks. I've done Greg Claiborne, and I did The Joy of Cooking. I guess that's your arch competitor, huh?
Oh, we're all in the same ball game. I mean, what can I say? But it's certainly one of our competitors, I suppose.
But my mother had the Better Homes and Gardens cookbook. I kind of grew up around it.
Sure.
And I have a ratty old one of my own that I've had for about 30 years.
Good. Well, we've got you a new one now.
Yeah, a brand new one. And my old one sits alongside My Joy of Cooking and the New York Times cookbook.
We're in good company then.
So those are the classics, aren't they?
Yeah, they certainly are.
Are there any other classic cookbooks?
Oh, along our same lines, I suppose the Betty Crocker certainly has to be mentioned. Fanny Farmer cookbook has to be mentioned along in the same lines.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've been around since 1930, so we've been in homes an awfully long time.
Was Better Homes and Gardens an established magazine in 1930?
Yes. Actually, the first cookbook was an extension of the magazine editorial, and that was in 1930, and we actually took reader recipes and put them into the cookbook, and it sold for $1.20, and the 20 cents was for handling, so it was a real bargain back then. But that's the way the cookbook actually evolved, came from reader recipes, you know. So that has changed about the cookbook. It's not reader recipes anymore, but that's where the first recipes came from in our book.
Have you seen the original recipe book?
Mm-hmm.
What do they
mm-hmm.
look like? How do they compare in appearance to the new ones?
The recipes or the cookbooks themselves?
Well, the new ones. Well, of course, the ones, as I recall, my mother's was in a binder like
that. It's always been in a binder, and that five-ring binder is patented by Meredith Corporation. It's a very special, we call it, it's a turtleback binder. You know, I don't know what that exactly means, but it is patented by us to lay absolutely flat. You know, so it is one of the better, there are several ring binder cookbooks on the market, but ours, you know, is a superior one, we feel like. It really, it's a good quality and does lay flat. You know, but it always has. That was part of the original 1930 cookbook. One of the things they touted was the ring binding. You know, so it has been that way since the 1930 cookbook.
Was it the same size?
Yes, yes. Trim size, just about. Might have been a little bit smaller. You know, but
have the same plaid cover?
No. The first cookbook was actually green, and then let's see. I've got some history. In 1935, it was silver, and in 1939, it was a blue and white cover. And actually, it was 1941 when the red and white plaid came around. And that's an interesting story. One of the food editors was on her lunch hour, and she happened to be working on some food photography that day. But on her lunch hour, she's wandering through a Des Moines department store and came across a bolt of red gingham fabric. And she liked it. She bought the bolt of fabric, took it back, and literally wrapped it around a cookbook and said, "This looks great." And that's how the red plaid was born. You know, so it wasn't something that was stewed over by art departments and analyzed by everyone. It just happened that way. But since 1941, then, it has been a mainstay with us, and certainly nothing will ever tamper with, because it's so easily recognized. And people will often see the red plaid, and they may not know the name of that cookbook, but they know they've seen it somewhere.
They've seen a classic.
That's right. And they know it's been around for a long time, and so we love that red plaid and the recognition that it gives us.
Well, how many recipes were in the original cookbook as compared to the new one?
I don't have an actual recipe count, but there were much fewer recipes because the recipes were so much lengthier. For example, the pumpkin pie, I know we've looked at recently just to compare. And, you know, you actually started out by having to stew your pumpkin, you know, cook the pumpkin down. And so you went into much more detail as to how you came about with some of those things. So they were much lengthier and tediously written recipes. You know, we've really streamlined our recipies since 1930. You know.
Now, I imagine they had to do a lot of starting from scratch.
Yes. I mean, literally starting from scratch. In a chili recipe we were looking at, even from the 1946 cookbook, you had to grind your own beef. You know, you started with some kind of steak, and the first thing you did in the recipe was grind the beef into ground beef.
My mother had a meat grinder. Mm-hmm. It was mounted on a counter, and I guess they took a steak or something. But now, of course, you go and buy chuck, right?
You buy chuck, or you can buy ground round, or, you know, there are lots of different kinds of ground beef to buy now. But
So in 1930, the pre-ground beef was not around.
Huh? No, you had to grind it yourself. Yeah, you know, so that's a big advantage we've got over over the cooks of yesterday.
Maybe that's why a lot of the chili recipes call for chunks of meat.
Yes, that's true too. That's true too, because if you got tired of grinding, you could just chop it up. You know, that's very true. That's very true.
What were some of the other recipes that you had to start from scratch to make?
Oh, really? Just about, you know, any of those meat-type dishes. I'm not sure I can call off any others that I think. We looked at the pumpkin pie. The fried chicken, I think, told, you know, you had to start by cutting up your chicken, you know, which we have done until fairly recently, but we don't call for that in this particular edition.
Well,
we're
Frank
calling
Perdue
for meaty.
Does it for you now, doesn't
That's
it?
Right. That's right. And, you know, we call for meaty chicken pieces now, you know, instead of cutting up your own broiler fryer. And you can still buy the broiler fryers in the chicken or in the grocery store, of course, and cut them up. But
well, it's cheaper that way.
Yes, in some cases it is. But again, you know, with this revision, we were so concerned about the busy people. And, you know, we're calling this revision the cookbook for the cook of the 90s. And the cook of the 90s doesn't have a lot of time to go home and cut up her own chicken. You know, she's wanting to start with the chicken pieces that are ready to go. You know, so that's, we really looked at the recipes as we revised this edition to see what types of things we could do along those lines to speed things up.
What about the dishes? The dishes of the 1980s compared to the 1930s? Do we have the same? Well, the recipes may vary, of course, but are they essentially the same dishes?
Yes, they are. They're essentially the same dishes. Chili has been around for a long time. It was in our 1930 cookbook. In 1946, it has progressed along. In fact, we did some comparison between a few recipes, and chili was one of the ones we compared from the 1930, the 1946, the 1968, and this particular book. And it was so obvious in that particular recipe how far we have come along in reducing fat in our recipes. The 1930 cookbook, actually, once you got your beef ground for chili, then you boiled it. And actually, the finished product came out much like the canned stews you buy today in the grocery store if you would go and open
it. You boiled the meat?
You boiled the meat to
in
cook
a chili
it.
Recipe?
Yes. First you boiled the meat, you know, and that's how you... And then you actually thickened it with flour, you know, for chili, which is we don't do that anymore today at all. The 1946 cookbook, we've come a long way because you started with ground beef in that particular cookbook, but then you browned the ground beef in, I think it was 2 or 3 tablespoons, maybe even as much as 1/4 cup of oil, which, of course, today is not necessary at all. We never call for browning our ground beef in any oil because you don't need it. You can just brown the ground beef and eliminate that extra oil. And in fact, when that recipe was all completed as written from the 1946 cookbook, there was about 1/2 inch of oil just sitting on top of the dish.
Did they take it off, do you suppose?
I don't know. I don't think so back then. I don't think, you know, we weren't as aware of you know, the bad aspects of fat and everything, and I don't think anybody thought anything about it back then. It was very commonplace, you know. But we have just progressed so much, and we know, you know, it's not necessary for to have that extra oil to brown the ground beef.
Well, when I brown my ground beef, I always pour the oil off.
Yes.
So that there's no oil.
But we didn't, and we call for you to do that in recipes today. You know, we will say, even if we aren't, you know, even though you don't have to brown the ground beef in oil, we still say brown it, drain if necessary. But in that cookbook, you went ahead and browned it in the oil, and we didn't say anything about draining it off, you know. So it was up to the discretion of the cook. And I'm sure there were health-conscious cooks back then, too, who did that. But prepared as written, you know, that's what we ended up with.
Well, I found it also saved time to, if I'm browning the meat, because I make a lot of chili, about the only thing I can do.
Oh, good, we hit on something you like then.
But I usually put the garlic and the onions in with the meat as I brown it.
Yes.
Because that way...
Yeah, you're saving a step.
Because I have seen recipes where it called for frying the onions.
Uh-huh. Probably in oil.
In oil.
Yeah.
And then frying the meat.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's not necessary at all.
You do it all at the
that's
same
right.
time.
Yeah, that's right. That's another way to streamline things. And you don't have to... There's no reason to cook that oil or cook that garlic and onion in any oil beforehand. You know, so we've come a long way with our health consciousness. You know, with this revision, we added a lot of poultry and fish recipes because we know the consumption of those things, you know, is up. And so people are trying to be a little bit more health conscious in eating those two things. We certainly did not decrease the meat chapter. It is also up in pages, you know, and number of recipes. But for the people who are trying to eat, and fresh fish is so much more available, too. That's another reason we increase the number of fish recipes. Fresh fish consumption is up, and it's much more readily available. You know, even in Des Moines, Iowa, I can, anytime I want to, I can go buy fresh salmon steaks or halibut steaks, swordfish, shrimp. I can get it all.
Oh, I grew up in the Midwest as a kid hating fish. It was just not fresh.
Oh, no, that's right.
And,
you never got any that was good because
never.
It wasn't fresh.
It was terrible. The only fish I would eat would be that which my father caught that mm-hmm. morning and my mother would fry.
Yes.
And I really didn't learn to like fish until I was in my 20s and moved east and worked in Baltimore,
uh-huh.
a television station in Baltimore,
uh-huh.
Which had wonderful seafood.
Oh, sure. And that's when you knew what fish really
yeah.
was.
Yeah, you could eat it and it didn't taste fishy.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
That's right. Are there any inherently new recipes that just weren't around
oh,
in the
yes. 1930s? Oh, yes. Lots of those. In this particular revision, fajitas. You know, that's very big in the Mexican restaurants these days. And so we included a recipe for that because people are eating out a lot, and they like to go home then and duplicate those recipes when they get home. You know, so we've given them fajitas, chimichangas, blackened redfish, you know, is very popular now. So we've included that in the cookbook.
Well, what is that?
It's a Cajun dish, and you're searing your fish in very hot spices, you know, and it literally blackens, you know, the surface of the fish because you're using hot spices and Cajun spices. And it's a hot dish, Cajun dish, but people really like that. So we've included that. But the classics are still here. We still have chocolate chip cookies in this revision, but we've given you an updated version with white chocolate and macadamia nuts. They're, again, just keeping up with the trends a little bit more. Pasta salads are in the book now. You know, back in 1930, we certainly didn't, you know, no one was eating pasta salads. And main dish salads. You know, people ate bigger meals and certainly would never consider making a salad their meal. You know, that was an accompaniment, certainly not their entire meal. And so we have lots of main dish salads in this revision, too.
You mentioned some of the new recipes. They all seem to mention pasta. That's obviously comes from the Italian. You mentioned
mm-hmm.
fajitas. That's obviously Mexican. But are there any inherently American dishes? Is there such a thing?
Oh, I think hamburgers are pretty all American. Let's see. What other things would be all American?
But our food in America is very derivative, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You can really almost trace anything back. Chocolate chip cookies, I think, are very all-American. But really, the origins of lots of our recipes can be traced back somewhere. I think potato salad is very all-American. You know, so there are some great American classics.
Baked turkey? That's probably American.
That's probably American,
fried
yes.
Fried chicken,
yes, that originated
the
in the South, and corn on the cob. And cornbread, I think, might be, you know, as far as breads go. You know, so there are some inherent American dishes, but we're a society that is so influenced by everyone around us and the mixture of cultures that we really, it's hard now to remember what was an all-American dish, what really did have its roots in America and what didn't. You know, lasagna certainly, you know, it's become a classic American dish, but it's, you know, certainly did not originate here, but people think of it. And tacos, you know, you just almost think of that as an American dish, but, you know, because it's been around so long, but it's certainly not.
I would assume steak dishes are
yes.
probably
yes.
inherently.
Yes, I think
filet
so.
Filet mignon. No, that's a French name, isn't it?
Yeah, that's French. That's French, yes. But I think a lot of our beef, because I think in the United States, I think our beef was more easily, you know, readily available to us and everything. So some of those, you know, classic meat dishes, you know, beef.
Well, I was in London once, and walking back to my hotel, I saw a man in a window charcoal broiling hamburgers.
Oh.
And they smelled so good. And so he made a great big hamburger, and I took it back to my hotel room, and I bit into it. And I immediately spat it out.
Oh,
it
really?
It was horrible. It had the worst flavor, the worst taste. It was not. It could not have been beef.
Beef.
It yeah. might have been beef, but... I don't know, but it was not edible, at least not to an American palate.
Not to you. It wasn't what you thought a hamburger was going to be.
It had the worst taste, worst flavor. I don't know if the meat was bad.
I wonder what it was.
I don't know, but I don't think, based on that experience,
mm-hmm.
that they know how to make hamburgers. unless you go to a McDonald's.
Yeah,
but
which,
even McDonald's aren't really like American hamburgers.
No, no,
they're too little.
Yeah, I'm gonna say that's not a all American burger either. You're right, it's not big enough. You know, we like
there is a famous restaurant here in Manhattan called the Coach House. While you're here, if you have a chance to stop in, now they specialize in very elegant American foods.
Oh, really?
Been
a
long time since I've eaten there. But even so, it looks to me as though a lot of the recipes there are derivative. But they always serve a cornbread with every mm-hmm. meal, and it's mm-hmm. been years, so I can't remember the specific dishes
mm-hmm.
I've had.
Mm-hmm.
But they boast about serving
classic American food. Is
yeah.
that right? Yeah.
And there are a number of restaurants in New York that boast this.
Uh huh.
But whether that's true,
yes, it's hard to trace. You know, it really is. You know, it's very hard to trace the origins of some of that.
Well, tell me what makes a good recipe as opposed to a bad recipe.
Well, I think I don't know that you ever have bad recipes. I think
you do.
I think what happens is the preparation.
Well, they make assumptions that you
yes.
know what you're doing.
Yes, and people don't follow the directions also. And that can make a bad recipe, or it can make a good recipe very bad very fast. And that's one thing we tell people is you have to follow the recipe directions. And we get calls sometimes and letters from people and say, well, this didn't work right. And so we talk to them. We always call them and say, well, okay, now tell me exactly what you did. And then the more you talk to them, you find out, oh, well, they substituted, you know, this for that. And, oh, well, I didn't have any of that, so I just left it out. You know, my husband doesn't like that. I substituted something else. And so more often than not, that's where the problem lies because, you know, we like to guarantee people that our recipes are going to work every single time you make them, and that's very important to us. But you have to follow the recipe directions and the ingredient list and don't go substituting things. But in this cookbook, we know people like to have a little bit of freedom, and they want to feel like maybe they're creating their own recipes. So in this book, we two come to mind. We have create a quiche, choose a quiche, I believe it is, and create your own meatloaf. And so we're in the meatloaf, for example, we give you several meat options. Use ground pork, ground sausage, ground beef, and we give you several herb options. You know, use basil one time and oregano the next and cumin the next or something. So we let you mix and match some of the ingredients. And that way people can play around a little bit. But we tested every single one of those combinations and we know you're going to still come out with a good product, but it gives you, if you don't like something, then you do have the option. But for most recipes, you don't want to go substituting things for ingredients because it can really drastically alter the way things turn out.
I clipped a recipe for some Cajun dish out of a magazine once, and the dish always turned out well, but it called for a certain ingredient, which I always prepared and had ready, but at no point in the recipe did it say where to put it in or how to use it. They just left it out. So I always put it in somewhere.
Somewhere.
And it always worked. But, I mean, they just left it out.
It
was a typographical error.
Yes, yes, yes.
But there are recipes that just aren't clear.
Yes.
Or they assume.
That you know more than you
yeah,
do.
I'm uh-huh. a computer buff. And if I get a new piece of software and the manual that goes with it, the manuals usually assume that you know what you're doing. And I'm suspicious of any manual that doesn't say, one, turn on computer.
Because
it makes an assumption that you have already turned it on, and that's mm-hmm. a wrong assumption, because a lot of us will try to make it work, and our computer's not turned on.
That's right.
Or at least
that's
this is me.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think that's the same way with the recipes.
It is. And that's why we don't, not just one person reads these recipes after they're written. They are read by numerous people, probably, seven or eight people altogether, before the book ever comes out, have read all of those recipes from start to finish just to catch things like that. You know, because it is easy, you know, if one person is working on it all the time, sometimes you do forget things. And so I'll write it and then another person will read it and another person will read it just to catch those little things because, you know, that can be very damaging to someone if we have left out an ingredient.
But
you know,
you've tried all these recipes out, I hope.
Oh, yes. We tested every single recipe in that book. Yes. And everything was tested at least once and most things were tested more than once.
But at what point? I mean, these are elaborations of previous recipes in the book.
Some of them are, and some of them are all new to the book. You know, there's a certain number of recipes that have never been in the book before. I really don't know the exact count of those recipes. But we retested every single recipe. And actually, the book started to be revised 3 years ago. And 3 years ago, what we did was sit down with the 81 revision and go through it page by page, recipe by recipe, and say, this is a classic, it stays. Now, this one, let's find something else to replace this. And we went through every single recipe that way and said, this stays, this doesn't. This stays, this doesn't. And we looked at every single recipe in that book. And then we went back and we filled in the holes. We developed new recipes, and we retested all the old recipes. You know, and we really watched as we retested to see if we could cut sugar and fat and salt in the recipes. Because, again, we're trying to be a little bit more health conscious. This isn't a health cookbook, but we wanted to make our recipes a little bit healthier for the average consumer out there. So every recipe was retested several times, and cookies, for example, we discovered we could eliminate the salt in almost every single cookie because it's not necessary. Salt in a cookie serves no purpose. And there were a few recipes that we did find they were a little bit flat without the salt. But
well, I always like, in brownies, for example, I always like the little salt flavor that I would get once in a while.
Yeah, and it's necessary in some things. But, you know, we did a lot of blind tasting, too. It wasn't all food editors who ate these recipes. When we were testing for salt, we invited lots of people to come into the test kitchen, and we would prepare the recipe as maybe it was written in 1981, and as we thought we might want to prepare it today for the 89 version with perhaps much less or no salt. And we asked them to compare the two and which one did they like. And, you know, we not just food editors tasted everything, you know, so we got a lot of outside help in letting us know where is the tolerance level for salt these days. You know, so that's one way we came up with where we were going to go with the salt in various recipes.
Have you found that some recipes became unpopular? People just weren't interested in them. They didn't cook those dishes anymore.
Not really. There were a few, I suppose, that maybe fall into that category, but everyone has their favorites. And even with this revision, we're not telling you to throw away that old cookbook of yours because you're going to have your favorites in there. And, you know.
Well, if it's Better Homes and Gardens, you can just take the old ones out and snap them in.
Well, that's true. That's true. You can do that. That's very true. That's a good point. But for the most part, you know, everybody's tastes are changing. And the recipes in this cookbook, even if they're in the older cookbooks, we feel like they're healthier in this cookbook. So if you're concerned about that, you want to get this cookbook because everything is just a little bit healthier than it's ever been before. You know, so that's one of the things we really tried to do.
Now, the Better Homes and Gardens cookbook, of course, is, as we discussed, a classic. But every year, hundreds of new cookbooks come out. Why do we need another cookbook?
Yeah. Well, this is a comprehensive general cookbook, and lots of the cookbooks that come out every year are much more specialized. They're all on desserts, or they're all on Mexican cooking, or they're all on bread. And so this cookbook has it all. It always has been a comprehensive cookbook because you can have hundreds, and there are lots of people who do have hundreds of these specialty cookbooks, but you still need to know how to stuff a turkey or make pan gravy, you know, make brownies, you know, the very basics. You know, people always go back to these comprehensive cookbooks for those because they aren't in some of these newer cookbooks because they're so much more specialized, and we cover the whole gamut. You know, we have the specialty things also. We have pavlova, you know, for a classic dessert, you know, with chocolate souffle, but we still are giving you the basics for poached fruit and rhubarb sauce, you know, and you can't find that in a lot
of... You can't find rhubarb either.
Well, we can in Des Moines.
Can you really?
Oh,
I don't. I've looked for rhubarb. My mother made the most wonderful rhubarb pie when I was a kid, and I never see rhubarb.
Here.
Well, you might, but maybe I haven't looked more closely.
Oh, that's too bad. Rhubarb's a favorite of mine.
Well, I'm sure we can find rhubarb in New York. You can find about anything else.
Somewhere.
But what's the point of these celebrity cookbooks, like the Bill Cosby cookbook?
Does he have one out now?
I don't know, but he probably he does. But what's the point of a cookbook like that?
Oh, I think it's just the novelty. You know,
who's going to buy it? I guess it has to be
somebody who likes
fan.
Bill Cosby. Yeah. I think just the novelty of it. You know, I think that's all they have. going for them. And they probably have some good recipes, But I bet if you go back and trace some of their recipes, they started with their mom's recipe, and I bet their mom started with a comprehensive cookbook like Better Homes and Gardens. Because that's how recipes get passed down. And if you really could go back and trace some of those recipes, they all started in a comprehensive cookbook somewhere, I'll bet you.
Do you read recipe books?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Trying to find out what the competition is doing?
Yes, yes. Of course, we're always, interested in what everybody else is doing. Sure, And there are lots of
You find some good stuff?
Oh, yeah. There are lots of, everybody's got some really, there are lots of cookbooks on the market that are great, But for comprehensive, the general cookbook, we feel like we've got the best one out there right now.
Do you collect cookbooks?
I don't personally, no. I don't have room. But we have a huge library at Better Homes and Gardens of cookbooks. So anything I ever need is there. So I don't personally collect them. But anything I would have, because as we develop recipes, people often ask us, where do we get our recipe ideas? And we get them from restaurants and from other cookbooks, from press releases we get, from the potato board or the kiwi board or whoever happens to send us things. We get ideas from them also, So we're constantly looking at other cookbooks that are out there just to see what's going on.
You must do a lot of cooking.
I try. I'm a weekend cook. I don't cook much during the week. I just don't have the time. But I'm a weekend cook, and I like to prepare things.
Do you use a recipe book?
Oh, sure, I do. Absolutely. That's right. I always follow the recipes, word for word.
I always do, too. I find that I tend to forget, even though I feel confident that I can probably reconstruct it.
Yes.
But I usually leave something out.
Yes, yeah.
Like the most important ingredient, I usually will leave that out.
Yeah, I was going to say, I follow the recipes pretty much.
So Better Homes and Gardens is based in Des Moines, huh?
Uh-huh. It's part of Meredith Corporation, which is a Fortune 500 company. And we are the book division, and there's the magazine division, and there's Better Homes and Gardens magazine, but Meredith also publishes Sale magazine, Metropolitan Home.
Sale magazine in Iowa?
Well, you can get it in Iowa. I think it's much more popular out here. But
has it always been in Des Moines?
Yes, yes, yes.
Since Meredith the magazine was founded?
Or yes, did, yes.
Has Meredith always owned Better Homes and Gardens?
Yes, yes. Better Homes and Gardens was the magazine, was started. And actually, when they came up with this idea for a cookbook, they went to several other publishers because Meredith was not into publishing books at that time. They were strictly the magazine. And we went to several publishers and said, we want to do this. Would you be interested? And people turned us down. No one wanted to publish this cookbook for us. And so we did it ourselves, and certainly today we're very happy that we did and would never turn it over to anyone else at this point. But, that's kind of an interesting sidelight that nobody wanted to do it. So we just did it ourselves.
As you say, it's right up there next to the Bible and the dictionary.
And the dictionary, that's right. Except for those two hardcover books, we sold over 26 million copies of this cookbook. So it is a mainstay at Better Homes and Meredith Corporation. It means a lot to us.
Well, it's meant a lot to many generations of cooks.
Yes,
and eaters.
Right. And eaters. And eaters as well. That's right. That's right.
Linda Henry, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.